Hello, this is Herb Solo, former head of Desilu Studios, Paramount Television, and MGM vice president in charge of worldwide television and motion pictures, as well as co-creator and executive producer of Man from Atlantis and executive in charge of the original Star Trek series. And you're listening to Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life.
Hey everybody out there in podcast land, welcome to Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life. I am your host, Joe Stuber. This is the place where we celebrate our favorite superheroes and comic book characters coming to life on the big screen, television, on stage, in animation, wherever they jump off the page. We talk about them here with some of the most incredible talents around. This week, I'm wrapping up my look back at the 70s sci-fi series Man from Atlantis. At the same time, kicking off my year-long celebration of the 50th anniversary of Star Trek. It is here, 50 years of Star Trek. This is going to be cool. Now, over the past couple weeks with Man from Atlantis stars Patrick Duffy and Belinda Montgomery, we talked about those two shows. We talked about the similarities between Man from Atlantis and Star Trek. There is a reason for that. And that reason is my guest in the lair today, Mr. Herbert Solo. You will hear from Mr. Solo in just a few minutes. Before we get to that, I want to remind you, if you have missed any episodes of Comic Book Central, Patrick Duffy, Belinda Montgomery, over 100 interviews are out there. If you'd like to go back and check out some of those episodes, or check them all out, even better, there are a few ways to do that. Of course, they're all on the website. It's comicbookcentral.net. You go to the archive. You'll find them there by month and year. You'll also find a link to where you can subscribe to the show and download all the episodes on iTunes. If you do that, please leave a review in iTunes. Would love to get the show out to as many listeners as possible. Those reviews help to do that. When you review the show on iTunes, that helps in getting the show out to more people. If you don't use iTunes, you can also subscribe to the show on Blueberry, or you can stream the show on Stitcher or on those services. Of course, each week I post the show on Facebook and Twitter. There's also an episode guide in the About section on Facebook. So if you're there, give us a like if you haven't already. Check out the episode guide. You see all the different guests that have been here. Twitter, it's at ComicBookCTRL. On Facebook, when you see the episodes posted, just click that share button on Twitter. Just retweet it out to your friends. Folks, you are the members of Comic Book Central Nation that are getting the show out to as many people as possible. The best way to support the show is to get it to even more people, help it continue to grow, and I thank you so much for doing that. Interviews like today are what Comic Book Central is all about. Digging through the history of our favorite TV shows and movies, talking to those people that were there right from the very beginning. As I mentioned, Star Trek turns 50 this year, but it might never have seen the light of day if it weren't for the man who is in the lair today. He is going to also guide us through our look back at Man from Atlantis. Check this out. I'm going to be right back then with Mr. Herbert Solo. As many great Hollywood stories start out, Herb started out in the mailroom, where he worked his way up at the William Morris Agency. Before long, he landed a network gig at NBC, and in 1964, he took a huge leap of faith by heading over to Desilu Studios, the production company formed by Hollywood heavyweights Lucille Ball and Desi Arnaz. Now, financially, Desilu was hurting, and as head of television production, it was Herb's job to find the shows that would keep viewers glued to their sets. In 1966, he discovered two wildly different series that 50 years later are bigger than ever. First, an action-adventure spy thriller. Mission Impossible lasted 7 seasons and 171 episodes on CBS. That original concept, a team of secret government agents performing, well, impossible missions, That concept is now a blockbuster worldwide film franchise starring Tom Cruise. The other concept Herb brought into Desilu? Well, that was a result of a meeting with a former policeman turned screenwriter named Gene Roddenberry. The show was Star Trek.
These are the voyages of the starship Enterprise. Its five-year mission, to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
After bailing on the initial pilot the year before, NBC, in a virtually unheard-of move, ordered a second pilot episode. Mr. Spock, played by Leonard Nimoy, he made the cut, but original Captain Christopher Pike, played by Jeffrey Hunter, beamed out, and on September 8, 1966, William Shatner took the center seat to sci-fi history. After Desilu was sold and became part of Paramount, Herb moved over to MGM, where he continued to develop television series like Medical Center and The Courtship of Eddie's Father with Bill Bixby, and feature films including Brewster McCloud and Clint Eastwood's Kelly's Heroes. After leaving MGM to form his own production company, Herb once again approached NBC with an idea for a sci-fi series. This time, instead of a starship, it was a submarine, and the strange-looking character didn't have pointy ears. He had webbed hands. He was the Man from Atlantis. Now, wrapping up my look back at Man from Atlantis today with the man who brought us the Man from Atlantis. He is also one of the main reasons we are celebrating 50 years of Star Trek. He is a writer, producer, studio head, author. He wrote Inside Star Trek, The Real Story. It is my pleasure to welcome a true Hollywood legend, Mr. Herbert Solo. Mr. Solo, welcome to Comic Book Central.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Happy anniversary.
Thank you.
Happy 50th anniversary. How many times has your phone been ringing this week?
There have been people calling interested in in interviews, discussions, going to some, flying somewhere to be on camera and such. It's been a bit hectic.
They want to talk about 50th anniversary Mission Impossible, right?
Yeah, that was, I'll tell you, Mission, I did Mission at the same time.
Yeah, you did.
Pilot and did the series, at least the first 3 years of the series. But there is not the interest, or hasn't been the interest, in Mission as there is in Star Trek.
I would put odds on that. Yeah, I think there's probably, well, I mean, we've got the movies now, which is kind of cool, but my goodness, this thing, Star Trek just became, it took on a life of its own, didn't it?
It took on a life of its own. It almost never made it, as I'm sure you know.
Yeah. That, I mean, we'll talk about the craziness that went on with all that. But and Shatner talks about this all the time, how, you know, it took him forever to figure out the impact of this. But, you know, lives were changed. People changed, you know, they took on certain careers because of the show. They met people, got married, had kids through, you know, because of the show.
There are people who have made a living, literally a lot of money, not having created anything but living off Star Trek.
Yeah. Are you ever able to sit back and just see it for what it is now? Or were you just so inside of it and it was just a gig and you move on? Or can you look at it as the phenomenon that it's become?
Well, yes, I can. I'm also helped by the fact that my wife, who's a university professor, and the former editor at the University of California Press, and she wrote a book about it. So she understands it, and I think she's helped me to understand it, because it's tough getting objectivity with something that you worked on closely every day for years, and you fought the battle with the networks and fought the battle with the sponsors and fought the battle with your own studio people who preferred that we didn't make the series because it cost so much money to make.
So. It's just so crazy when you think about that. Again, well, it just, yeah, such an odd way of looking at it too. But any plans to celebrate for the 50th? There's events going on. Shatner's, he's doing the music of Star Trek. That's touring the country, all North America.
Of course he's doing that.
He's everywhere. He's...
Yes.
Any plans? Yes. Are you going to hook up with Shatner at some point on one of these events and talk to the crowd?
No.
Okay. I tried. I gave it a
shot. I'm sorry.
Give it a shot. That'd be cool. Do you have any plans to celebrate? Are you going to be at any of the events?
No.
Are you going to pop in a DVD and have a bourbon?
Not going to do a thing, no.
We'll celebrate for you.
You know, let's put it this way. Life goes on, Joe, right?
Yes, it does. Yes, it does. Yeah. And for many of us, Star Trek is a part of it. We'll celebrate for you. How's that?
Thank you very much.
See,
one thing that's very important is most of the people still with us today were not there when we first started to develop the series. Shatner wasn't there. Shatner came well after.
Yeah.
Because in the pilot, we had a different actor, Jeffrey Hunter. So when we did the second pilot and the series, we recast, and that's when we hired Bill. So everything that went on before that, very few people know.
Yeah, so many things had to fall into place, and so many pieces you moved into place, and Roddenberry moved into place. Yeah, we'll talk about that. Let's talk about some of those things that you did early on, though. Look, you always hear about these cliches in the movies and TV. The young kid working his way up from the mailroom and makes it big.
True.
You did that. That's you.
It's true, yes.
You're the kid. Yes.
It was very strange at that time because I had just graduated from an Ivy League college, right? So it wasn't that anyone who goes into the mailroom to start off, people would say, what are you doing? You just graduated from Dartmouth. What are you doing going into the mailroom in New York City at a theatrical agency? My theory always was that if you want to get into the entertainment industry, the television motion picture industry, this is the postgraduate course. I mean, this is actually doing it. It's getting involved in the daily activities of what it means to be in the entertainment industry. And it worked.
Well, that's what I was curious about. So then so that answers one of my questions. And you targeted this. You wanted the entertainment industry, and that's where you went.
Yes.
What was it about the entertainment, the industry, showbiz, whatever you want to call it? What was it about that had an appeal to you? Did you see something? Did you watch something? Were there celebrities that you just wanted to manage? Or
no, when I was in college, I wrote plays, I directed plays, I acted in plays, I ran the Dartmouth radio station. I was always involved in things theatrical. And so the natural bent was when I graduated from college and looked into the job market, that's the area that interested me most. And that's where I went.
What can you tell us about your first meeting with Lucille Ball and Desi Arnaz?
Lucy and Desi were divorced at that time, so I did not meet Desi at that time. I was working at NBC in charge of daytime television programs for the West Coast, working in Burbank, California. And I got a call to see if I wanted to be an executive at Desilu Studios, right? So I arranged a meeting and with a guy who was then the president of Desilu Studios. And I said, yeah, this is what I want to do. A few weeks later, I reported to the studio. I went into the studio, parked my car, and they said I should go to Stage 12. Stage 12 was where they would shoot the Lucy show, right? So I went there, and there on the stage was Lucy. Went up, and I said, hi, you just hired me. And she said, get me some shows. All our shows have been canceled. I said, okay, wow. Thank you very much. Goodbye.
Oh, man.
That was it.
How are you, or, you know?
No, well, it was kind of, she was busy with her show. Lucy was the ultimate professional when it came to her own show, or anything, I'm sure.
Yeah.
But with her show, she wanted everything done properly, so she was busy. I understood that. I went to my office, and I started working, and luckily, within a few years, I had two major shows on the air. Made Lucy very happy.
Well, and take us back a little bit to that time, too, because for some of our listeners that, I mean, how, divorced at the time you mentioned, but still a power couple. And they've got, how powerful were they at that time? Because I know she was like in the middle of like two of three shows that she had for CBS. It was like CBS loved her.
CBS loved her. She had an exclusive contract with CBS, and she just did the Lucy show, right?
Yeah, she did I Love Lucy, and then she was in the middle of the Lucy show, and then she had another one after that. And
the Lucy show, well, I don't know about that because I left the studio. I left Desilu when it was purchased by the company that owned Paramount Pictures.
Right.
A company called Gulf and Western, and they merged Desilu into Paramount.
Okay.
And that was on a Friday, right? On a Monday, I'm sitting in the same office. My car is parked below in the same parking space, and I'm now vice president of Paramount Pictures. Things do move quickly, Joe.
Welcome to Hollywood, right? Okay, let's go back to 66. We're going back 50 years here. But my goodness, and you even look at the television lineup at that time. I mean, these are just some powerhouse shows that are coming out of this. But like you said, the 1-2 punch, Mission Impossible, Star Trek.
Right.
Unbelievable. How do these shows, and specifically Star Trek, how does that come into your life, and how important were they to Desilu at that time?
Okay, it came in as follows. Desilu was hired. Desilu had made an arrangement with a theatrical agency to represent it, right? So some of the agents at the theatrical agency would send in some of their writer clients who had ideas, and they'd send them to me. Three of the writers that came in, I made deals with. One was Bruce Geller, who had an idea of a series called Briggs Squad, which we later changed to Mission Impossible. The second group was two writers named Lincoln Levinson, who had an idea about a detective, which we called Mannix. And the third one they sent over was a producer, writer, named Gene Roddenberry, had a thing called Star Trek.
Okay.
That's how they came to me. Right?
I love the part in your book when you describe the meeting with him. Take me back to that meeting with, because we can look back on 50 years and we know Roddenberry and we've seen him in it, and we know what Star Trek has become. Take me back to that very first meeting with Roddenberry.
Well, Roddenberry, here's information that maybe your people, your listeners, or your readers aren't going to like. Gene was not a talented man. Gene dealt with ideas that other people had. And he dealt basically with money. His interest was in making money. Gene came in with basically Buck Rogers. Do you remember the comic strip and also motion pictures of Buck Rogers?
Yeah, you had Buck Rogers, you had Flash Gordon, you had the serials, you had the comic
Buck
strips.
Rogers in the 25th century, it was a spaceship going through space, traveling, what have you. Gene had made various changes in it so far as having a character named Mr. Spock. The problem with that character was that Gene had him as red with a tail. He was, in essence, the devil. I mean, really, Joe, he was the devil.
Is it? It's described this way in the script?
It was described this way in Roddenberry had a piece of paper, of paper he had about the Mr. Spock character, had a pointed tail, he was red, he was the devil.
I was wondering if we were going to get to the scrap of paper. I love that part of the book. It's just like...
And
do you still have that scrap of paper?
No.
Oh, can you imagine how great a story would that... You should just say you have it. That'd be a great story.
Yeah, I know it. Well, the first thing, of course, you had to change was the devil, right?
Yeah.
You can't do a television series and ask sponsors to put up their money in which they're advertising a series dealing with the devil as a positive character, right? It just doesn't work.
Unless you got deviled ham.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
You can do that. That's about it. One commercial and out.
there were other changes. There were changes of characters. I changed a lot of names. I also took the idea and moved it into a flashback because I've always felt that to viewers or listeners or readers who don't know science fiction or, you know, futuristic science fiction, that a lot of that stuff could be something they would just not understand. I felt they would understand it more if a storyteller was telling them what happened in the past. In other words, it had already happened, and having happened, it's true. I mean, it's a reality, it's already happened. And thus, we came up with Captain's Log, which Shatner, or before that, Jeffrey Hunter, would look at the audience, in essence, say, tonight's story is about the following.
What convinced you that Star Trek was going to be a hit?
Well, let's put it this way. Star Trek wasn't a hit.
But that was one of the ones you wanted to take to Lucy. Why that one?
No, I did. I did not take it to Lucy. Quite frankly, I get very arrogant when it comes to these things. My job is to decide what we're going to do, right?
Right.
And that's what I did. So I had already made a deal to develop Star Trek and to develop Mission Impossible, and at that time to develop Mannix.
Okay, so you're just taking series in, and let's make these the best we can.
The best we can, pick the ones that are good for us.
Okay.
They were then, there wasn't any script. There were on two of them, there wasn't even a story. So it's a matter of sitting down with the writers and developing everything.
Okay. Now, you alluded to the fact, and it's obviously become history now, that we got two pilots. We've got The Cage, which ended up being a two-parter in the original series. But that original pilot was shot, Jeffrey Hunter, as Captain Pike, which very cool now that we get to see Pike on the big screen. But we have that. What was it about that first pilot that the network just couldn't get behind?
Well, they could not get behind various things. And by the way, it's something I truly understood because, as I mentioned earlier, I went to Desilu from NBC. I was an executive at NBC. The people running NBC, the president of NBC, the executives at NBC, were all friends of mine. So I could understand when they had a problem. Their problem with it was, if you know the film, they had a problem with the green dancing girl, okay? They just felt there were some markets in which NBC felt they could not sell the show, basically in the South. So they decided not to go ahead with the series, but they truly, truly were thrilled with what we did, the production. Remember, Desilu was a little tiny studio. The only show they had going at the time was the Lucy show. Desilu made its money by renting stages, renting space to Danny Thomas's show, to things like I Spy and to Mary Tyler Moore and what have you. And so NBC at first was not, well, they were wary that little Desilu could make this kind of pilot. They were thrilled with what we did, and I sat with them, and we talked about it, and we decided that NBC would order an additional pilot.
Okay. Now, you had originally taken it to CBS first, right?
No.
Oh, okay. The thought was to go to CBS, but because they had Lost in Space, that they had passed.
No.
Okay.
Let me tell you what happened, okay?
Okay.
By the way, Star Trek is so riddled with rumors, with half-truths, with plain lies, what have you. Most of them, by the way, perpetrated by Roddenberry, but that's some other story. When we were working to come up with a concrete approach to what Star Trek will be before taking it into the marketplace, Roddenberry, I took it to NBC, and they were thinking about it. Roddenberry and the guy who was head of Desilu at the time, a guy named Oscar Katz, to whom I reported, unbeknownst to me, took it to CBS. And they had Roddenberry make the pitch, right?
Okay.
Probably the worst idea you could ever do is have Roddenberry pitch anything. When we went to NBC, I refused to let him speak. True story. We walked in there and I said, Gene, I'll pitch the show. These are people I know. They're friends of mine. I'll talk about it. You just answer questions and mumble. And he does. He would mumble. So the bottom line to the whole thing was CBS, if CBS had said, yes, we will do it, they couldn't have done it because they already made a deal with NBC.
Okay. So it, so it was kind of going in two different directions, but NBC kind of came out on top there. As you mentioned, unbelievable to order a second pot. That just doesn't happen, does it?
No, it doesn't. In fact, one of the problems we had, one of the reasons we had to change casting for the lead is that usually when you make a deal with an actor, the star in a pilot, you have an option to go from pilot to go to series. No one ever considered having an option to go to second pilot.
Pilot to pilot, yeah.
So when we ran the show for Jeffrey Hunter and his wife, stood up and said, my husband is a movie star and does not do television. Thank you. Goodbye. Hmm. We had no legal option to hold him. So therefore, there's no way that we could put Jeffrey Hunter in the second pilot, even if we wanted to, which between us kids, we did not. Then along came Shatner.
Okay, I was going to ask you, Monday morning quarterback this thing for me. If you get a mulligan, do you want Hunter or you're locked in on Shatner?
Oh, I would stick with Shatner.
Yeah. What did he bring to it?
Well, he brought the one, he is, in some of the shows it may not seem it, but he is a very fine actor, number one. Two, he brought a leadership to it. I mean, you could believe he's the captain. When he's on the bridge and he sits in the chair, you know it's his chair. I don't think we knew that with Jeffrey.
I couldn't agree with you more. I think that's in every episode. The second he gets on the screen, the guy in charge. That's the guy you're following. Yeah, that's the guy you're following right to the ends of the earth. Okay, so you shoot the second pilot, where no man has gone before. Okay, so is that written as Pike? Or because Shatner came in, they rewrote it? Was it Kirk the whole time? How was it written originally?
If I'm trying to recall how it was written. It was written by a man named Sam Peoples.
Yeah, and we're going back 50 years, so, and I apologize for, you know.
I'm trying to think how it was written. I suspect it was written with Kirk.
Okay, because I know you've got the original Doctor in it. That's the other weird thing I get.
Yeah.
Okay, so you shoot this thing. It's got some of the cast we know, some not. You get the original Doctor in there. So okay, so you shoot that as the pilot. That's supposed to they pick it up. NBC picks it up. That's supposed to be where we're going. But that's the third episode that airs. The Man Trap. Of the series, yeah, the Man Trap actually is the premiere episode.
The Man Trap, it was
okay.
Either the fifth or the sixth episode that the first one on the air. The reason it was first one on the air, just so you and your people know, is that we did not have a lot of optical effects in that episode in Man Trap, and where No Man has gone before, I felt that it could send the wrong signal to the critics and to the audience that this is what our show is about all the time. When you do a pilot to sample film, right?
Yeah.
If you go into the market, and they have a little stand there and they're giving away samples of food, if you taste the food, you expect if you buy the product, that's what it tastes like.
You were afraid of setting the bar too high.
Well, I was trying
That's the executive in you.
Well, what it is, I was trying to get us good reviews.
That's amazing. Because you look at it and you're like, you watch the premiere, technically the premiere episode, and there's the cast we know and love, and then two episodes later, it's like, wait, who are these people?
Yeah, well, we did a little change.
Did anybody just go?
Well, we also, in a kind of rough-hewn manner, we thought we explained it away. I'm not sure if we did,
okay.
But bottom line, it worked.
I can't argue with you.
Again, going back to what I said earlier,
yeah.
It's a storyteller telling a story. If you're telling a story, you can make changes. It's not happening now. It's already happened.
Yeah. You make the best point. It worked.
Of course it worked.
There's no way I can argue with that. Toughest battle you faced with the network?
Well, there isn't any really battle. The network people were my friends. Before going to Desilu, I worked with them every day. So therefore, I could pick up the phone and call Herb Schlosser, who became president and chairman of NBC, Grant Tinker, Jerry Stanley, all the guys with whom I worked. I could pick up the phone and call them, and we'd talk about it. Working with NBC was great, just great. They were always supportive.
Toughest battle you faced with Roddenberry?
That became a very difficult battle because Gene had certain desires that were not in keeping with the way I wanted to run the studio, bottom line.
Not show-related, but more studio-related?
More personally related.
What was the toughest battle you fought with him?
Well, one of the battles, Lucy, I always wanted him thrown off the lot.
Completely off the lot.
Yeah, she didn't want him around on her lot at all because of some of Gene's personal habits.
Okay.
I won't go into it further.
Okay. And you fought to keep him on?
I fought to keep him on to the point where he had spent a lot of time traveling the country talking with fans, right? There was a major push with fandom, as you know, with the show.
Yeah, built that grassroots campaign.
Oh, yeah. And I thought that was important for us. I didn't want to damage that. So I just convinced Lucy that I would take care of it and tone down Roddenberry and his habits, which we did. But then other things happened. Desilu was bought by the company that owned Paramount Pictures, as you know.
Right.
Desilu was merged into Paramount. And suddenly there were a whole group of new executives with whom I was dealing, and I just felt it just wasn't the same old fun anymore. It wasn't of interest to me. I'd achieved my goal, my purpose. I got Lucy 3 new shows on the air. Mission, as you know, lasted 7 years and is now in movies. Mm. Mannix lasted 7 years, and the only one that was not a complete success was Star Trek, lasted 3 years. After I got
Go figure,
Star
huh?
Trek, yeah, after I got Star Trek renewed for the 3rd year, then I decided to leave.
Amazing.
And I went to MGM.
Amazing. Yeah. Now, speaking of the show, you did tackle quite a few moral and social issues.
We did.
War, racism, feminism, so many. How far was Gene allowed to go with that? How much further did he want to go with that?
Gene was not heavily involved in the production of Star Trek. The man behind it for the first year was a man named Gene Coon, who I hired as the producer-writer. Because Roddenberry was not a dependable producer. Gene Coon was. So a lot of that stuff came from Gene. A lot of that stuff came from the writers we hired, Harlan Ellison and George Clayton Johnson and Theodore Sturgeon and Richard Matheson. I mean, really quality science fiction writers.
Yeah, guys coming from the world of science fiction writing, science fiction literature.
Yeah.
Coming in from that, yeah, not necessarily television writers, so per se. But did you accomplish what you wanted to accomplish as far as those issues, tackling those issues, or did you want to go further with it?
I think we did. I think we did as we went as far as we could go because a few of them NBC bought that.
Yeah.
So they just said, you know, they just balk at it.
What was the battle you picked with them that you weren't going to back down on?
I think everyone.
Was the kiss between Kirk and Uhura?
One of the main problems was we did a Vietnamese story, Vietnamese War,
mm-hmm.
and in NBC programming wasn't a problem. NBC News became the problem, the news division. The NBC News division said, you know, do entertainment, don't do news. And we were making comment on the viability of America's involvement with Vietnam.
A little bit of pushback on that then?
Yeah, we had to. There was always a problem with sponsors.
What's the one that you sneaked by them that they didn't even see coming?
I think we did that several times. Remember, the NBC program people on the West Coast were our friends.
Okay, so you kind of, yeah, so they weren't going to give you too much pushback.
No, they would not. They were understanding, what have you. They just had a problem with Gene. That's their problem.
Yeah.
So I had to keep him away from NBC.
A studio head's job is never done.
Yeah.
Favorite episodes of the series? Do you have any that stand out for you, the ones you just kind of smile when you see them pop up?
I like them all.
Oh, come on. You got to, yeah, that's a lot. 79, that's a lot.
Let's see, which ones?
Obviously the pilot. Obviously the second pilot, because
I
that's the one
the
that
pilot.
Got.
I liked Charlie X. I remember that.
Yeah.
I liked things that had more thought to it and less shooting.
Yeah.
That's what I like.
What about and one that sticks out in my mind, too, and it's sort of a tour de force for Leonard. Well, Amok Time. Obviously,
right.
that's the one that's you know lives on today in so many other movies. But I thought the Galileo 7, where they're stranded on the shuttle. He's kind of leading the crew down, and he has to make a decision, and he basically makes a decision that's completely un-Spock-like.
Right.
And I thought that was amazing. Just that you could take characters that were like, oh, this is exactly what this character is going to do.
And then it differently.
Flip it. Just completely flip the script. So,
bear in mind, Leonard Nimoy was a very close friend. And whenever we had something that we needed done importantly, we would deal with Leonard.
Your thoughts, you mentioned the Mission Impossible movie. Your thoughts on the new Star Trek movies? Because they kind of kept it in the same universe and then went back to your era of Star Trek. You got the red shirts, you got the yellow shirts.
Quite frankly, I've just seen a few of them because I was asked by BBC to review the Star Trek movies for them. So I saw a few, but quite frankly, I haven't seen all of them.
Okay, so these are the... Now, have you seen the J.J. Abrams directed ones?
No, I haven't.
Recent ones?
No, I haven't.
Do you have any intention of seeing them?
Probably, I'm sure I
do. I'll take that as a yes.
You know, Star Trek was not the only thing I did.
No, I know. Look, it's one of the biggest ones, but you just led me right into it. You led me perfectly into it. Man from Atlantis, one of my favorites. One of our favorites here. Where did this idea come from?
Okay. There's a difference between an idea and developing a television series, okay?
Yes.
In other words, when you say, I want to do an idea about a cat that rules the world, right?
How are you going to do it?
Okay, that's an idea. That has very little value.
Right.
In fact, legally, you can't protect that. It's an idea. When I had my own company, that, as I said, was owned by Taft Broadcasting Company, one of the lawyers came to me and said, I have an idea about a guy from Atlantis is found lying on a beach. That was it, right?
That was the entire pitch.
It wasn't a pitch. It was, by the way.
Like over lunch.
And I said, okay, so let me look into it, because it has to be developed into a property. You can't sell or make a film based on an idea.
He didn't have a scrap of paper in his hand, did he?
Nothing. Oh, no. I had enough scraps of paper. Please, Joe. So we ended up, I hired a writer friend of mine named Mayo Simon, who's a very talented man. And Mayo had, the last thing he had written was a movie called Future World. And so Mayo and I worked on putting together the basic concept and some of the characters, and Mayo went ahead and wrote the script, and that's how it happened.
Yeah. Now, I interviewed Patrick Duffy a couple weeks ago. He mentioned that once you personally decided that you wanted him, you were not about to let NBC say no.
Correct.
What was it about Patrick Duffy? And he even told us he's a skinny kid at the time. They put a big bodysuit on him. What was it about Patrick?
Wait, we hired a trainer.
Yeah.
And we put him on a special diet.
Right, but even before then he said
even
before then he said they had this foam padding suit on to get him.
Of course he did. Yeah.
What was it about Patrick that you just went, "Yep, this is the guy"?
There were two actors that I interviewed, dozens of actors for the role. There were two that I liked. One was a guy named Christopher Reeve, who later became Superman, right?
Wow.
And a lovely man, by the way, who died young, unfortunately. And the other was Patrick. Patrick was thin. Patrick looked like he could use a good meal. And when I took him over to NBC to introduce him to NBC, because remember, if I have an idea of something I want to do, that's what I want to do, right?
Yeah.
So a lot of people don't like that, but that's the reality of getting things done. So I took Patrick over to NBC for a meeting to introduce him to the NBC people and for me to advise NBC that this is the person who's going to play the lead, right? Remember, he's thin. He had a marvelous background as far as training as an actor. But before we got to the meeting at NBC, we stopped off, and I had Patrick put phony eye lenses into his eyes. So his eyes looked deep blue, right? They were not lenses that were made for his eyes. They were lenses that I forget how he got them, but they were lenses. Mm-hmm. So Patrick put them in his eyes, and I had to hold his hand to lead him into the NBC office because he couldn't see, right? So we go into the office, and I say to the guys, these are the NBC vice presidents and such. This is the guy who's going to play the lead in Atlantis for us. His name is Patrick Duffy, et cetera, et cetera. And Patrick just almost like nods, right? But he can't see anything. So we have our meeting, and Patrick.
He's not reaching out to shake anybody's hand, apparently.
Oh, no. Yeah. So the meeting's over, and Patrick and I walk out, and NBC asks me to come back for a moment. I come back and they say, "What's wrong with him?" I say, "Nothing wrong with him, please." So bottom line, they all agreed, "Okay, Herb, if that's what you want to do, go ahead and do it." And we went ahead and did it. That's how it worked.
Oh, great relationship with these folks then, that you're able to pull that off. And
oh yeah.
The perfect guy for it too.
Yeah. I'm sure I cannot have done that at CBS or ABC.
Yeah. Now your wife even mentioned to me, you still have some stuff from the set, don't you?
We have a few things, yeah, that have been in storage for a while.
You got the air tanks from the pilot?
The first one that happened, it's in the main title, yes.
That's great. That's great. Let's talk about the pilot, your cast, Belinda Montgomery, Patrick Duffy, Victor Buono. Oh my goodness!
Love Victor, yes.
How do you get Victor Buono in on this? Because he's such a great villain, as Schubert. Oh, by the way, does Schubert have a first name?
I don't think so.
Okay. I couldn't find it, so, but you're the guy to ask, so.
Okay.
I will assume that he has one, but we just don't know what it is. Correct. How do you bring this cast in?
Well, I was very fortunate having a very good guy who did my casting. He did our casting. I hired him at MGM to do casting, and for my company he did casting. He would present me with a list. We'd interview various people. Victor Buono I had known about. And so far as I thought, he just fit perfectly for a friendly villain. And said, yes, let's do Victor. Belinda Montgomery, I forget how we got her.
The chemistry between the two is great. Did they ever talk about eventually, if the series had gone on, getting the two together, because the chemistry is off the charts there?
I don't think I would have done that, because they had, each one had a different attitude of what they should be doing on the show. They had different approaches to how cooperative they were going to be on the show, and it gets to the point that I decided that I would not do that.
So keep them apart.
Keep them apart. Yeah.
Okay. You got the four TV movies, and we talked about this with Patrick. It's almost like fits and starts. NBC just can't commit to a series. Why were execs at NBC so hesitant about committing to a series initially?
Well, there were a lot of affiliates who did not feel that this type of show was conducive for them. Remember, a network is made up of hundreds of affiliated stations. You need them behind you because you want to place your NBC wants to place its program on someone else's station. I'll tell you something. It was good that when they saw the pilot, they did not totally abandon the show. They put up money to do the four movies.
Right.
We did the movies. The ratings were really good, and they decided we put the show into series.
Okay.
The series, one of the problems with the series was that people were unsure who the audience is.
Okay, that's what I want to ask you about. There's a definite shift in tone from the TV movies, which I kind of compare to $6 Million Man-ish a little bit, to series, where, as Patrick described it, and I kind of feel the same way, is that it's Star Trek underwater.
That's, in essence, what we were trying to do because it gave us leeway.
Now, why the shift in tone? Did you just want to try a Star Trek series, or was the underwater thing? Because he ends up in like these Elizabethan plays, and he ends up in the Old West.
Right. Because what happens is, think about it. How many shows can you do with a guy who lives underwater?
Right.
I mean, how many shows can you do? Can you do 7 years worth?
It gets a little slow. Right.
Of course. So we had to be able to go into an area where we could grow, right? We could do things that are a little bit weird and such. Atlantis, we could play with color. We could play with characters. We could come upon weird people. If you remember, I had a giant living under the water, right?
Yeah.
We had really, I mean, it's science fiction gone astray, I think.
Yeah, it gets really crazy. Well, and kind of like the Cetacean becomes the Enterprise. There's uniforms. We've got the little insignias. So, you know, Patrick is Captain Kirk at that point. He's sitting in the center seat.
Yeah.
And these guest stars, I mean, talk about some of these guest stars. Dee Wallace, Billy Barty. I mean, you talk about eclectic. Billy Barty, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar.
Yeah, I know. Interesting, huh?
Was there stunt casting involved? Did you kind of look at that and see, like, maybe the old Batman TV show where you're kind of like...
No, we want it to be a bit different.
Okay. Because Patrick talked about the camp. It became a little more campy.
Yeah, it became at times a little too much.
If you would... Yeah. Did you sense that when you were in the middle of it, like maybe we went a little too far with this?
I sensed it. But I think the cast was already, the die was already cast. I think this is what was going on. This is what the audience liked. There was a problem so far as I mentioned earlier, who is the audience? For a while, it was played as a kid's show. Mm. Is this a kid's cartoon? Is this a kid's show? You realize that comic books were made up, don't you?
I'm looking at seven of them right now.
Okay, so you have all of them. So,
I got them all.
So is it what?
Lunchboxes,
what kind of show
toys. There was a toy line that was coming out. Do you have a Victor Buono action figure?
No.
Okay. I know there's a prototype. But yeah, it's trying to find its identity.
It's trying to find where it belongs,
yeah.
Right? Remember, where it belonged, and there was a political thing involved also. Political, not dealing with contemporary politics, but with the fact that people at Taft Broadcasting also owned Hanna-Barbera, right? The guy who was running Hanna-Barbera was Joe Barbera. Joe had tried for many years to get a non-animated show on network television and had failed. I quickly got one on the air, did not make him happy. So when Atlantis went on NBC, I think at 8 o'clock in the evening, as a series, Barbera went ahead and made an arrangement with CBS to let them use his best animated series so in order to combat Man from Atlantis.
Mm.
So this is a kind of ego thing going, and I must tell you, it worked for him. It did not work for us because we lost part of our audience, which were the younger audience.
Yeah, it's a shame. Yeah, because they're the ones kind of getting into sci-fi too. Were they ever going to explain the origin of Mark Harris? Because he's the man from Atlantis, but there's also a reference to him by Schubert that he might be an alien.
I know. Yeah. No, I mean, at least, well, what happened is if we had been renewed, if the show had been picked up, then I'm sure we would have explored all avenues.
What avenue did you want to explore? Did you want to go down the alien route, or did you want to do the Atlantis route? Or, like Patrick said, it may have been an amalgam of the two.
I think it always has to be the two.
Okay.
The one scene that, to me, tells us about the series, you may recall, there is a scene where he's in a phone booth.
Yeah.
And he can't get out of it.
Yeah.
Because regardless of how smart he is or how experienced he is with underwater, with the world, whatever, he doesn't understand how a phone booth opens.
Right.
Because he's an alien.
Regardless of whether that alien happened to live underwater or not.
Yeah, that's right.
J.J. Abrams, he went back to your 1966 material, Mission Impossible, directed mm-hmm. part three. He's been a producer. He went back to your 1966 material, Star Trek,
right.
A couple of films. He went back to 1977. He's blown up the box office with Star Wars.
Mm-hmm.
What are the odds that maybe J.J. Abrams could go back to 1977 again with the return of the man from Atlantis?
I don't know. It isn't for me to say, of course.
But you're the guy. You have a vested interest.
I think he would be crazy to do that.
You're breaking our hearts.
Because there isn't that freedom to go. There aren't that many sides to Atlantis. Not the many sides to Mission. Not the many sides to Star Trek.
So you don't think the character could continue? You don't think the character could be rebooted as a feature film?
Bear in mind that Warner Brothers owns, I think, has an arrangement with DC Comics, and that's Aquaman.
Yes.
They have already talked about doing something on Aquaman. Years ago, Warner Brothers financed a script for an Atlantis movie. I read the script. It was terrible. And I don't think anyone would fool with it anymore.
Were they rebooting it or were they continuing it?
The Gladys Knight was for a movie.
And so it was just basically a new, all brand new.
Adventure dealing with the concept and the characters of Man from Atlantis.
Okay. Would you be interested in getting involved in another Man from Atlantis project, or you think that that's just gone?
I think it's gone.
Okay. No, just curious, because they talk about Aquaman, they talk about these things, they talk about Prince Namor.
Yeah, I know.
There's going to be a superhero underwater movie at some point. This is one of the characters that always comes up. So you're the guy to talk to. What are you working on now? So what's new and exciting in the world of Herbert Solo?
I'm working on a screenplay, but I'm not going to tell you anything about it.
Can you give us a genre?
Genre?
Yes.
It's a love story.
A love? Okay. Does it take place underwater?
That's an idea.
Well, okay.
Boy, am I glad we're talking.
When can we expect to possibly see this? TV, feature?
I don't, theatrical.
Okay. All right, so we might be able to see a brand new Herbert Solo production.
Something like that.
That'd be great. Is it the website is SoloVision?
Well, that's one of them, but we don't. I'm not that active, and as I said, I spend my time working on things that I want to do. So I'm not. Quite frankly, I'm not really living in the past. So I'd rather just look to the future and do my next thing.
We are looking forward with eager anticipation to that next thing. We love the character. We are so glad that we got Man from Atlantis, even what we have. Maybe we'll see something in the future. Who knows? But we thank you for that. We thank you for your role in launching Star Trek. Look, you've given us decades, and I'm talking decades and decades and decades of fantastic shows. I love Mannix. I love watching him roll around on the hood of the car. I can't see somebody, you know, in a car chase without thinking of Mannix. I think maybe Shatner took that from him for T.J. Hooker. I think so.
I'm sure he did.
I think he may have done that. Look, these shows are wildly entertaining. I love that Lucy asked you to bring them all those years ago, and you did it.
I tried. It worked.
It worked. We thank you for that. You're going to hear this a million times this year, but, sir, live long and prosper.
Okay.
And thank you so much for joining me on the show today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you, Joe.
Love learning new things here on Comic Book Central. Not sure if you listeners knew that Christopher Reeve was up for Man from Atlantis. I did not know that information. In fact, following that interview, I did a little digging around, and it turns out Christopher Reeve himself did mention it briefly years ago in an interview that's posted online. Again, I wasn't aware of it, but it was very cool to find that out. Think about so many twists and turns with some of our favorites over the years. If Lucille Ball doesn't put Herb in charge, are we celebrating Star Trek's 50th anniversary this year? If Christopher Reeve gets the role of Man from Atlantis, is the Superman movie a worldwide smash hit? I don't know. We don't have to find out. You know, as Patrick Duffy mentioned a few weeks ago, you know, sometimes things happen the way they're supposed to happen. The right people get involved, and we get these amazing successes. But it's interesting how just a few twists and turns here and there could change things up. Good stuff today. My thanks to Hollywood legend Herbert Solo for stopping by. If you want more of the kind of Star Trek tales you heard today, you've got to pick up Herb's book that he wrote with his producing partner on Star Trek, the late, great Robert Justman, who also worked on The Adventures of Superman in the 50s, by the way. The book is called Inside Star Trek, The Real Story. In the book, Herb gives a lot of credit to Robert for keeping Star Trek going for those three seasons it was on NBC. The book has been referred to by many as the definitive making of Star Trek book. I know there are a few accounts written out there, several of them by the cast members themselves. But I will say this thing is packed full of inner office memos, letters, telegrams, really, really inside studio stuff. A lot of it from Robert Justman's personal collection. It is compelling. Check it out. Decide for yourself. Read it. Write into the show. Let me know what you think. That book was also made into a television special. Now, I only see that it's available on Amazon in VHS format. So if you've got a VHS player, that's cool. Go get it. It's crazy cheap on Amazon. If not, I have seen the special uploaded to YouTube. I'm going to put all those links so that they're easy to find. I'm going to put them on my website, comicbookcentral.net. They'll be in the show notes for this episode. Again, my thanks to Herb Solo for chatting with us today and talking about Man from Atlantis, Star Trek. I think Man from Atlantis obviously is the show that gets lost in all this, but it doesn't get lost here on Comic Book Central. Fun times. Really enjoyed that conversation. Folks, as I mentioned, this episode kicks off my celebration of the 50th anniversary of Star Trek. Just getting warmed up. I plan to have more Trek guests in the lair this year. Not the first time Trek has been represented here, though. If you haven't already, you're going to want to check out these episodes of Comic Book Central. Episode 7 from Star Trek The Next Generation, Marina Sirtis and Jonathan Frakes. Episode 20, the great Julie Newmar. She was Catwoman on the Batman TV series, but she was also in the second season episode, Friday's Child. We talked about that. Episode 34, I met up with Beverly Washburn at the Monster Bash in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. She was on the season 2 episode, The Deadly Years. Episode 51, another Catwoman on Star Trek, Lee Merriweather. Third season, That Which Survives. We talk about her episode there. Episode 56 of Comic Book Central, really cool one. I met up with Deep Space Nine's Terry Farrell and Michael Dorn. Episode 67, the captain himself, William Shatner. He was here. We talked about the original series. We talked about the movies. Talked about Leonard Nimoy. Talked about T.J. Hooker. Talked about a lot of stuff. We also mentioned how he thought he could show up in the new movie if he is indeed in it. That was a very funny moment. You're going to want to check that out. And episode 92, quick little chat with Deep Space Nine's Chase Masterson at Trivicon in Connecticut. Hope to have more with Chase this year, so stay tuned. If you have not heard those conversations, be sure to take a listen. The website, comicbookcentral.net, they're in the archive. iTunes, you subscribe to the show, you get them all. Blueberry, Stitcher, they're on there as well. I promise more Trek is on the way. If you've got family members, friends who are Star Trek fans, tell them about Comic Book Central. Share it on Facebook, retweet it on Twitter, share it through social media. Get the show out to as many people as you can. There's going to be some fun stuff coming up. Hashtag share the lair. If you're on Facebook, I've also got my pictures from my adventure at Marvel Universe Live over there on the Facebook page. You're going to want to check that out. So give us a like. Check them out. I finally put them up there. I know I've been promising for a while, but they are there. And keep your comments, ideas, emails, your suggestions. Keep them coming. joe@comicbookcentral.net. That's how you can reach me. You can also go on the website. Click the Signal Me tab there on the website at comicbookcentral.net. And that wraps up my look back at Man from Atlantis. My thanks to Patrick Duffy, Belinda Montgomery, and of course, Herbert Solo for joining me these past several weeks. Don't forget, you can snag the entire series. That's the 4 television movies and the 13-episode series Man from Atlantis from the fine folks at the Warner Archive. There will be a link to order it in the show notes for this episode at comicbookcentral.net. Go check it out. All right, that's it for today, kids. I'm out of time. I think I'm going to head into the cetacean, take a trip underwater, see what's going on for a little bit. But I shall surface soon enough because next week on Comic Book Central, you do not want to miss the beginning of Flashback, Flash Forward February on Comic Book Central. Starting next week and continuing all month long, I'm going to look back at some early TV projects and some more recent adventures featuring our favorite Scarlet Speedster from the pages of DC Comics, The Flash. Next week, from the original live-action CBS series, he played Julio Mendez, Barry Allen's lab partner at the CCPD. He's also the voice of Nick Fury from the animated series The Avengers, Earth's Mightiest Heroes. Actor Alex Desaire, he is going to be here. Mark your calendars. Make sure you are back here for the flash-tastic start of Flashback, Flash Forward February on Comic Book Central. Until then, watch out for those underwater giants. Keep reading those comics, and thanks for joining me here in the lair. Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life. This podcast is intended for entertainment and education purposes only. All original content of this podcast is the intellectual property of Comic Book Central and is licensed under Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivations, 3.0 Unported License. All other content and names are registered trademarks and copyrights of their respective holders.
Star Trek, the most discussed and far and above the most written about series in the history of television. But over the years, much of the history of the original or classic Star Trek, the when, why, where, and how of the legendary series, has become lost. And much of what remains has become clouded. Rumor has become fact, myth has become reality, and truth has become fiction. This video, Inside Star Trek: The Real Story, goes a long way towards setting the record straight, to credit those who contributed importantly, and properly introduce them to the Star Trek world, to tell their story, to tell the real story. You won't see any of the Star Trek actors. You've all heard and enjoyed their stories for over 30 years. But you will see and hear for the first time from the people who employed them, paid them, wrote their characters, created their worlds, the people who put words in their mouths, phases in their hands, hair on their heads, clothes on their backs, and music in the galaxy. These are the people who truly created Star Trek. Most of the people you will see have never spoken publicly about Star Trek, but they are doing so now. And they're not talking about what did not happen, only what did actually happen. After all, it's their story too.